Having established ourselves with a meditation object that anchors the mind, after arriving in the room, arriving in our aspiration and our intention, arriving in inviting mindfulness, having gone through the body and breath, and this anchor being steady enough, that we don't lose our mindfulness, or if we lose it, we recover it relatively soon, relative being a very wide area, we can open to this fourth of the Satipatthana, the knowing of the Dhammas, so we could start out with, I'm just going to pick three of these. We could start out noticing some hindrances of mind when they arise. It could be sleepiness. It could be sloth. A kind of fatigue of the mind. It could be wanting mind. It could be aversive mind or deluded mind that just wanders off. And when we experience one of these in our practice, because we have a here and now presence, we can recognize it. It may be a while before we wake up to recognize it, but we can recognize it. Oh, it's a hindrance. It's just a hindrance of mind. It's not me or mine. It's a hindrance of mind that we all share. And then we see the dukkha in it. And we see if we have choice. And we choose to go back to the breath. Or we stay with it and know it more deeply, but without getting lost in it. So wanting mind might be in the form of a story or a memory or a plan or an idea. An aversive mind, the same. We're not hating them, but we're seeing them and their limitation if not known. And likewise, we might notice when the mind has energy, when it's got this curiosity, this investigative factor, or the mindfulness itself is really strong. Or we might notice this kind of surge of interest, this kind of rapture of interest, a kind of showering of interest, an energetic experience. And we might note that the mind is really calm. Or that the mind is equanimous. So I'm just noticing when the mind's, there's favorable attributes. You don't have to know the list all the time. You just notice, is the mind in a favorable position, cooperative or not? And then finally, you would notice the experience of the Four Noble Truths. We've done these first ones. So you notice if there's an experience of dukkha, or if there's an experience of clinging. Or you notice that the mind has temporarily put clinging down. And you're only doing this when your mind's drawn to something that you discover, okay, here I am planning this or thinking about this or having a big discussion with myself. What's the nature of this? What are the characteristics of mind that's present for this experience. You're non-judging, but you are discerning. Likewise, you could pick a thing, a topic, an experience, like, okay, so what is this about wanting mind? Do I understand wanting mind? And you just do an inquiry. Or you bring up a person that's difficult where you have aversion, because you really want to know aversion. You want to understand it from the felt sense. So you're deliberately creating a circumstance where you can safely investigate it. This too is the knowing the Dhammas. Many ways to work with it. So along the way, you started in the body with your anchor object. Along the way, you may notice the pleasant and unpleasant, even in the Dhammas. And you notice them in these mind states that arise. Wholesome and unwholesome mind states. Or if that's too strong a language for you, challenging mind states and easeful mind states, if that works better. If you don't have any interest in this, you just continue on with the practice as it began. No requirement, just an offering. In line with being available to the Dhamma in this moment, you can just open what wishes to be known. Or what is the nature of clinging? Just open to the Dhammas without using anything specific. And then you can stay back with your object that anchors you as long as you want, including the rest of the sit. Please give yourself permission to respond to the sit the way it's unfolding, rather than trying to impose. at this point in the set, you could choose to or not to introduce the idea of letting go. So if you discover the mind's going to someplace tangled, you can let go in a general way as you come back to the breath. Or you can let go specifically of that storyline, that object, that point of view, that reaction to that experience, that reaction that's controlling you in this moment. Just as an invitation, may I let this go. May I let this go. So there's many ways to practice the examination of the Buddha's description of this realm. All of the lists are very helpful in that. So the hindrances, the five aggregates, the five faculties, and on and on and on. There's a smaller number of those in the Satipatthana, that for Satipatthana, that are suggested. But some of the others might be better at some points in time. Those lists are they're ways to organize what we notice, and that's their value. One could divide things up in other ways. So you could take the five hindrances and make them seven hindrances, or make them three hindrances. There's an arbitrariness in, to some degree, because it was just a person making a list. But there's clear seeing in the way it was made. It's not that there's not other ways that there could be clear seeing, but somebody's already done the work, and all these people for thousands of years have tread that path. So now why are we going to make up another list, you know, in a different way? But we don't want to, like, they were made from an enlightened understanding, but it's not like handed down from God. It's a different feeling than that, so that one can be a little more loose with it and all this. But there's real value to having some organized way to examine our experience in relation to what are the factors that are present that cause us to suffer, and what are the factors that are present that cause us to not suffer, but in fact become healthier, become freer, and have more choice, and so forth. So that is the value of those. And I'm sure that there's all sorts of different things presented here at SIMS that address this. And the way that we've studied this weekend, Tweri, who's one of the two co-guiding teachers here at SIMS, she and I have now spent a number of retreats teaching together. And so much of the way that I'm pointing to experience here, you can continue in your follow-up with Tweri and what she's doing in her Monday night classes, and when she and Tim alternate them in some pattern I don't fully understand, but they do that. And you can do that, and you can also ask for particular things that you're interested in. Can we have more of? From any teacher that comes, you can ask Tweri or Tim, say, I was really interested in that area. Could you help with this in some way, help get us to spend more time on it? I'm saying this not completely with Tim's permission, since he wasn't around to ask, but I'm saying it anyway. Tweri gave me permission for me to be able to do this. So I'm covering broad ground today at a fairly deep level, but we're not doing repetition. So we could have spent the afternoon just repeating the morning quite productively, you know, and that's good learning. But since I'm only here once a year, I try to cover a lot of ground, and whether or not that's the best or not, it's not something I consider. It's just what feels right to me. I go ahead and do it with you this way. Again, I'm being transparent here in terms of the teaching style and the learning styles involved and all. I value transparency, and when I'm the student, I like the teacher saying, well, this is what I'm doing, why, as opposed to just doing it. It may not matter very much to you, but I do. I appreciate it, so I practice it. So this third noble truth, the third ennobling truth, and it was so nice to hear you say ennobling. It really sounded like I was going, yeah, you know, because I seldom hear anybody say it that way. And you can think about it for yourself and how you want to hold it as a third noble truth or a third ennobling truth, is that there is an end, there is a cessation to this relationship that the mind has to suffering. Not that there's a cessation of, as I kept stressing yesterday, of the dukkha of being in this realm. Body dukkha lasts as long as there is a body. There's no getting around that. And and when I say body, I mean the heart quality also. So, I mean, the Buddha lost two of his favorite students, And he had to go through that as because that was in a human realm, and when we're in a human realm, these things happen. And so, but how we receive them can vary so much, because if we understand it as the natural part of this realm, we don't add anything extra. We just feel the loss, the sadness, the loss, but that loss also can have a celebratory quality to it. But if we're in the clinging mode, that clinging, that why did this have to be, why me, and so forth, comes out quite differently. So in this third noble truth, one gradually becomes more capable of having this awakening. And the fourth noble truth, the following the Eightfold Path, is the way one gets there. But again, the three insights have to do with the penetration. So there is that there is an end to this is a speculation. It's a theory. It's a philosophical or whatever you want to call it. It's a conceptual understanding of possibility. It's a presenting of a possibility that you agree or don't agree with. You can contemplate that, and then there's the actual practice of the whole process of the Dhamma that's the call to action here, that you really commit to this as a way of life. And then this has been known as like you do know. So I wanted to mention two things. But one is that some years ago now, quite a few years ago, Andy Olinsky, who used to be the person in charge at the Berry Center for Buddhist Study, wrote an article in Tricycle Magazine in which he talked about the difference between a psychological experience and a spiritual experience. And the psychological experience has to do with the way we perceive the world is changed in relation to our kind of our personal history. We're psychologically able to meet the world in a different way, because that's our kind of personal psychological, our ego component meeting the world, and those formations that I talked about, those personality formations, which is the word I use. I'm not sure that it would be used in psychology the way I'm using it. But again, I make this differentiation between the ego and the way it's structured, and these intrinsic kind of behaviors or perceptions that are somewhat independent to dramatically independent of ego, and I call those personality formations. That's one level of experiencing, when we are doing this practice, we have psychological liberation. We have psychological understanding that comes because when we're not clinging, we see more clearly and things let go. So there's great psychological experiences that happen. On the spiritual level, it is more of a kind of a reformulation, and makes the most sense if you believe in multiple lifetimes. But it works also, in my view, in a single lifetime, because the orientation and with the psychological is still to do with the ego and the ego being okay, which you will hear referred to as transformation in a minute. But on this level, it is a reordering of the very strands of reality at the spiritual level. A whole reordering, and I'll try to demonstrate that when I talk about the three stages of realization here that I presented as an alternative view when talking about cessation when I wrote Dancing with Life. And a monastic person that I deeply, deeply respect, whom I was very concerned about how he was going to respond to all of this, actually said that he thought that I had not made a mistake. So that was really quite meaningful to me, because this is just I'm now being subjective. This is not the way the Buddha presented this, what I'm getting ready to do. But it is actually what, in my own experience base, which has so many years in it, it's a way that I could organize it for myself, and I'm sharing it with others. And so from this kind of way of thinking about cessation is a word that, and Nirodha is another word, and Nibbana, all these different words, what exactly do they mean? So there's times in meditation when things go blank, and then you come out of that. Some people think that is what cessation means. It is a kind of cessation of the flow of consciousness. The flow of consciousness does stop. That is not what I would call nibbana or cessation, any word like that, but it may be. How can I know? So, but my own experience wouldn't suggest that. So, cessation can, for me, the real meaning, and I'm going to use it in other ways here, but that it is the end of having a mind that is motivated by greed, that gets controlled by greed, by any kind of wanting. It's a mind that ceases to be controlled, defined by any kind of aversion. It's when wanting ceases, when aversion ceases, and then when delusion ceases, that is nirvana. The mind is free at that point, and the point is made that it's an uprooting of these three. It's an uprooting. It's not enough to like clear the surface, because if you don't uproot it, the seeds are still there, and it will happen again. And one way to understand how these unfortunate things happen with spiritual teachers is that they cleared the level ground of it, but it did not get uprooted. So that's one way to understand that. And I've named this now twice, and I may well name it again, because I don't think we have to. First of all, I personally don't need my teachers to be perfect. I don't need them to be perfect. I certainly prefer that they be honest, but they either possess knowledge or not, and I can either tolerate their behavior and support it or not to the degree that I can learn from. But if we demand perfection, good luck, and perfection also assumes we know what is perfection. And perfection can often be social convention. So, and there's different social conventions that in a culture always, and we can get a little puritanical, a little rigid about this, maybe from at least from my point of view, and get in the way. So that's the other side. So here I've named the difficulty, and now I'm naming the other side about a kind of tolerance. So that's the balance that you have with your teachers between those two. And it is your authority. Even if you embrace the guru model, of which, you know, there's various forms of that in the yoga forest tradition, there's a lot of guru kind of things. And meaning that up in the, you know, Himalayas, but then in the Tibetan, there's a kind of guru version that's different. But nonetheless, but even then, we still hold our own authority, from my view. So I studied the nine bodies with a teacher that is very much a guru to people, and he would kind of keep waiting for me. I've said this to his face, so I'm not speaking behind his back. He would keep waiting for me to treat him as the guru, but that's not the model I embrace. And he would say, he would confront me about it, and I would say, but I don't embrace that as a spiritual practice model. But you're Kalyana Mitra, you're my spiritual friend, and you're senior to me. You know what I don't know, and I want to learn from you. But you're my spiritual friend. You're not to break open my ego for me. That's my job. You know, and so we each can have our own model about this, and we can have degrees of it and all. But I urge you to always be your own authority. And I've taken him as an instance. When I first met him, I was not particularly impressed. I didn't know about the Nine Bodies teachings. I wasn't particularly impressed. And I'd gone there for a specific thing having to do with my throat and a kind of wounding, whether it's physical or psychological or both, that I've carried my whole life. And I'd heard that he was a person of great knowledge, and so I went there and asked for his advice on this. And he gave me advice, and which I have employed, and which I do think it helped some. Then he said to his attendant, show him around the ashram. And so the attendant did, and when I got back to go down the hill to leave the ashram, he was standing there. And he said, "When are you leaving this country?" And I said, "In 2.5 days. And he said, "Well, where are you going right now?" And I said, "Well, I'm going to Delhi to catch a plane because we're going to da-da-da." And he said, "No, you can't leave. You can't leave. You've got to stay here. I've got things to teach you." Now, I was not particularly impressed, I'll say again. I wasn't like, I didn't have some great projection on him and, "Oh, this is so wonderful that, he's going to teach me something." I didn't have any of that. I was like, "Why is he bringing all this up? Now I'm going to hurt his feelings." I mean, it was not, I didn't have this kind of big opening kind of moment with it. But he held his view. He held it. And as he was holding it, that gave me time to think, "Well, so what if he does have something to teach me? Why am I rushing off when I'm not rushing? I'm rushing off for more stimulant, to be exposed to more things, but I don't think I'm rushing off to go get exposed to some great depth of something else. I'm in a way in my sort of, like a pilgrimage kind of role. It wasn't like a spiritual tourism, but it was more of a pilgrimage. I'd been at the Mahabodhi Temple and this sort of thing." I said, "So why would I not take a chance? Why would I not take a chance? Am I never going to take a chance?" So I took a chance. And it turned out to be really a wise decision. Arduous decision. I did not know what I was getting myself into. But that opened, that it led to a kind of understanding that I would not have had otherwise, that very much mirrored my practice experience in Vipassana, but which the people who had brought the Vipassana over didn't that was not what they were interested in. They did not make reference to that. And so I found a language, I found a map for something that I was already experiencing, but I had no organization of it. And that was very useful to me, and it's turned out to be useful to others too. And that happened. There was nothing special about me. It was just that I was willing to be in don't know mind, because I'd been introduced to this idea of being open. So I was able in this moment, for whatever set of conditions, to be open. And the same is true for each of you. We're not different from one another in that way. And sometimes we're going to be open and it was a waste of time. I was once with I was at the Forest Refuge for a 30-day retreat, and the person that was the teacher, those days they just had one teacher, and this was actually a monastic. And he did a little interview with me, and he said, "Well, I've not had the experiences you've had, but if I'd had this," he named a particular experience, he said, "all I would do is practice recreating that experience. And I said, oh, I don't practice that way at all. You know, I don't, I make myself available to the Dhamma, you know, and I get still at everything that I've done with you. I'm done straight from my practice. And then things happen, you know, things just happen. They unfold because I'm not pushing in any direction. And as the more still I get, the more collected and unified and all, then things happen. And I will investigate, like I encouraged you to investigate, but I really don't do that. He said, well, if it was me, I would. So I walked away, and I stewed on it for a day, and I was going, well, what if he's right? No, he's not right. That doesn't work for me. I've tried that. I go into striving. I go into pushing. My personality, it's not a good idea to do that. But how do you know, Philip, if you don't try? So, not unlike what I was doing in Rishikesh with Bhav Yogi Pramvarani, the same kind of consideration. So I said, okay, I'll try this. I went back to him. I said, I'll try this. And 30 days wasted. I could have put them in a fireplace and burned them up all at once. The thing I learned from that was that my self-assessment was correct. And I could have been bitter about that, or I could have been amused, and I was amused. Like, but it hurt. It stung, because it's rare to get 30 days to practice, you know? And so it stung that I had made a poor decision. But I did not fall into this, you know, judgment about me, and I had no feeling about him. Because for the next person, if he said the same thing, it could be exactly the right thing for them. So, I mean, potluck in that way. We don't know what we're going to get. And so having an open mind to this, I have found the best way for me. Some people need a real structure where people, it's this, like, just like this, and then it's just like this, and they need that. And if so, then that's smart for you. That's wise. You're doing according to how your mind works. My mind works in a much more a relaxed way. Just the stillness, all this ground, all of that I took you through that this morning, that worked for so many of you. That is the way my mind works. But I found out how my mind worked. I practiced long enough, a lot of different ways to find out. Each of you have to find out what works for you. People can get intuitions about how what will work for you. And I'm very specific about technology. I'll say try this, try that on a retreat. I'm really specific about it. But in the end, nobody can know but you, and you can have a feel for, oh, this feels right, but then only when it's what manifests is what we know. And it's always changing anyway. You know, so, but as we look into this third noble truth, we're talking into, like, what does this exactly mean? And don't get so fixed about it, is my suggestion. That's the fact that in the second noble truth, we're to let loose of tanha, of the cause of suffering. That is an organizing point. That will work no matter what. And so the idea of what exactly comes, you know, in this third noble truth, the Buddha mostly taught via negative, right? And that's that via negative is the Greeks did that. Using the negative, it's not this, it's not that, and then what's left is what it is. And by breaking you open, oh, it's not this, it's not that, you kind of fall into it. You get, as opposed to being described positively, where you create a concept of it and you don't have the direct experience. So that's how the Buddha taught. So when we get to this third noble truth, you know, we're on a little bit of moving ground. So for me, I viewed it as, and still do, as three stages of realization. That is the way I can imagine this and have felt this happening in me and witnessed it in others and seemed to be manifested quite fully in a very few people I've met. And that first level of realization I call the transformation of ego. And all of these, and I do, so when I say that, I should have used the word stages. There's mind moments. There are mind moments, so we can have lots of mind moments. But mind moments come and go. Stages of realization are more stable. They still fluctuate before they get stabilized for many of us. But mind moments come and go, and we can have an exalted mind state that's quite a high level of mind state, but then it leaves and we're back to where we are. And lots of people have that happen to them. Lots of people have wonderful moments. Some of you were reporting wonderful moments in here today. They come and go, but this stage of realization, this is a stage of capability that emerges. And the first of these stages I refer to as the transformation of the ego. And the transformation of the ego is when we are maturing psychologically through our spiritual practice. That's going back about. So the way we're seeing the world from our ego's point of view is different. And it brings with it a sense of ease. There is a definite change towards selflessness, which makes you available to others. A definite switch in that. And we're still organized around our ego, but the ego's identity is transformed, so it's not based on this self-referencing in the same way. So therefore, one's much more available to for others. And once that self-referencing just, it's really dramatically lowered, although it's still there. And so we're less likely to fall into unskillful behavior, although we still will have parts of ourself that, you know, we're causing suffering. And so cessation at this level means cessation of being self-referenced as you think you are yourself. You think that this me and mine is the real reality, and we move away from that so that we've opened to this other reality. And then the second stage of this, and I'll describe in Dance with Life, is the transcending the ego. And so at this point, even when the ego is transformed, we are still resting in ego. Our core identity is ego, but it's a transformed ego. But we're still there. And then when we're transcending the ego, then it's a new foundation where there is not the there's not that same self-reference at all. And this transcendence can happen very slowly over a period of time. The Buddha talks about the gradual path, or it can be an all-at-once experience. Those of you who've seen the book, the Nine Bodies book, there's an illustration in there where it's called sudden awakening, and it sudden awakening sort of feels like that. I thought he did an amazing job of capturing that. So, Jack Kornfield has a very good book that people haven't read as much as they had his other books. It's called After the Ecstasy, the Laundry. And people can have this moment of transcending the ego, but they miss the transformation of the ego. So we all hope they go back and do that transformation, because they're going to cause us a lot of trouble if they're out here living their identity as having transcended ego, when in fact they had a period of time where they transcended ego, but they still can, when they get totally into unity, when they're in that oneness, they are these wonderful people. They're just, but then, outside of it at all, even having lunch, they're back. They've got a split. They've got a split. So when in this transcendent stage like this, you know, the personality is still there, and there's the quirks of personality, but we're not acting in ways that would harm others. If it's a true, if we've gone from transformation to transcending, then the ego's not important enough that we will harm others to gain something. And when I say gain something, I don't mean like gain money, but I mean like having to be right or needing to be the center of attention or whatever it would be. There's an ease of meeting others that changes in this, and there develops this ability to spontaneously respond to what's called for. So just whatever appears in front, you just spontaneously. It's not like an agenda thing. Doesn't mean that you wouldn't, if you're in Thailand, try to stop all that deforestation that's going on, because that's what's in front of you. And you do, but you're not doing it from an ego point of view. You just go, oh, this is harmful. And so so there's not this, there's not a kill for peace kind of feeling, like we've witnessed in Burma, unfortunately, in this last period of time. So there is a, I would call it not being someone new, but you have become more true what you always were, from my perspective of that. There has been a development, but that development brings you to your Buddha nature. But there was development. Without the development, there was not access to that. That would be the way I would call it, but I don't mind if you call it another way at all, and I would never argue about it. There's degrees of transformation of ego. There's degrees of transcending the ego, but you start to have more moments of ease. That there really is an ease in life, and the ease in life is not based on conditions so much. You still are affected by conditions, but it's much less. And the deeper the transcendence, the more full the transcendence. The more complete the transcendence, the more that your ease is, your sense of well-being is not based on conditions. And if we're fortunate, a person that's had this is responds with humility and realizing what's still to go and all, and doesn't become inflated, let's just use that word, and doesn't lose their way. And so at this level of transcendence, again, this is from my experience of this, is that we cease to identify so much with duality, again, in degrees. So it's not that duality is thrown away, it's just that we don't have that identity with it. And so from that perspective, oneness and duality are the same, because we're not identifying with the duality. As it's, you know, gain and loss, the worldly winds that I talked about this morning, all duality. And but at this point, there's still the organizing mind is still subject and object mind. There is a knowing. There's a knower that is knowing experience at that point, even though it's not identified in the same way. And so at this point, we are still dancing with life, but it's not such a struggle. And then, again, from my point of view, that's my subjective experience, the third stage is where there evolves more and more a degree of transparency, and that transparency can first appear in moments, or it can appear and stay. That degree of transparency comes and more or less stays. It may fluctuate, but it stays. It can happen either way. And we are now transparent to ordinary reality, literally seen through. It's not, ordinary reality isn't solid in the way that you and I experience the solidity. It's transparent. It's dreamlike nature is, the Buddha describes it like a dream, like foam on the ocean, that ordinary reality. It is seen that way. It's not like an analogy or a metaphor. It is literally how it is. It's how it's seen. And at this point, we are no longer dancing with life. That we're not involved in the duality in a way that we would be dancing with life anymore. And so we're organized in a different way. And from the people that I've seen that I've thought about, it's like the becoming directly part of the mystery of this that illuminates ordinary reality. They're now part of the mystery rather than part of the ordinary in that way. And this is the sure heart's release that the Buddha talks about. It's a mind free. So there is now a cessation of any kind of grabbing, of any kind of clinging at all. That's the cessation of greed, hatred, and delusion. House builder, you will build no more. I have torn down your central pole, the Buddha said. There's no longer... the sense gates no longer burn with greed, hatred, and delusion, he says in another place. So, and when this morning when I was saying, Agate, Gate, Paragate, Parasham, Gate, Bodhisvaha, this Gate, Gate, Gone, Gone is this kind of trance, is when it's at the transformation. Gone is your old relationship to ego. Gone beyond, Gate, Gate, Paragate, gone beyond, that's the transcendence. You've gone beyond ego. You're not centrally organized around ego anymore. Gati, gati, paragati, parasham gati, bodhis, svaha, unfathomably gone, unimaginably further gone, further than gone beyond. So there's gone, gone, there's gone beyond, and then there's this level that's far beyond gone beyond, and that can't be described. And that's the transparency that I'm referring to, and gati gati paragati parsham gati bodhisvaha into awakened mind, yes, ah, in that moment, and so attachments and fetters have dropped away. The Buddha says, luminous is this mind, brightly shining, and it is free of the attachments that visit it. Luminous is this mind, brightly shining, and is free of the attachments that visit it. So the Mara kept visiting the Buddha in the suttas, but Mara couldn't find any place to land. He couldn't find any. There had to be something there that would respond, something that would cling to. That was just fall off. I love that. And I love that Mar kept visiting rather than he's like some godlike figure. And another time the Buddha says, awareness without feature, without end, luminous all around. Here, water, air, fire, and wind have no place to land. No place to land. Or no, there's another word. Have no footing. No footing. Have no footing. And... whether or not you believe that is possible, it is directionally useful. Some people that I respect believe that certainly transformation is possible, and they believe that transcendence is possible, but that's it. And I have complete faith that transcendence is possible. And it is my suspicion that it is possible that transparency is possible, and that the Buddha did have that experience and so forth. But I don't know. If I find out, I'll let you know. And if you find out, you let me know. Okay, I really want to know. So, but I don't have to know. I don't have to know because the Buddha talks about. Forward leading, onward leading, that the teachings are onward leading, forward leading. And so directionally, if you feel that you are a better person, that there's a freedom, that there's an ease, that there's a well-being in the way you're coming, in following the path, then you're on the path, you're in the Dhamma. You're the Buddha knowing the Dhamma. And like, so why is that not enough? Why is that not enough? So what is it we're wanting? A guarantee? And how? Where else are you getting those guarantees? In other ways you could live your life? Where do those guarantees are? I'd like to see those guarantees. Because people hold their spiritual life to a higher degree of proof in that way than they do, you know, consuming drugs or eating food or getting attention, getting status. But does that really work out? I mean, when you actually look at those experiences, like, do they really meet? Could they meet the higher standard that's being demanded of the spiritual life? So then to just quickly finish up here with this for a moment, the fourth noble truth is the Eightfold Path. And if I'd had nerve in writing Dancing with Life, not only would I have said ennobling truths, I would have also put the fourth noble truth ahead of the third. But I just couldn't do it. But in some ways, it is in our practicing the fourth noble truth that we start to even be able to imagine the fourth noble truth. I know the idea of the, you know, this is the, and not just in Christianity, but other things, the city on the hill, the cathedral on the hill, the citadel, all of this idea that we get a vision, which I've actually had those kind of visions, and that those visions then lead us on. But for me, you know, the thing that's been most reliable for leading me on is just to practice. So, I mean, maybe you're more the inspirational type and you can just live on inspiration, but I kind of need to practice. And I am the practice, the Buddha says the Dhamma is good in the beginning, in the middle, and the end. And how we feel that is in the practice. Otherwise, I don't know. We want to be careful not to create a belief system when that is not what Buddhism is. It's not a belief system. It's not ontological. There's not a creation myth. There's not a where it's going to end. It doesn't have that. It just lacks them. It's not ontological. So my great belief in practice, and there's so many good Dharma talks on all of the Eightfold Path. One thing I would say only about it is that it is one path. It's not eight paths. It's one, and it is folded. It's folded within itself, so each is affecting the other. It's enclosed. It's enfolded. The enfolded path. My boy, there's another one I could get in trouble over. But do you know what I mean about that? It's not sequential. It can be understood sequentially, and you could argue that there's some sequential development, but in a way, not really, because, I mean, so much later on, you know, what's right view becomes like, oh, what I thought was right view, oh no, this is now right view. It just, it's not, so it's enfolded that way, and it makes it much more fun to do. As a practice, it makes it much less a check-off kind of list. You know, I've done this, I've done that, and more of a, I'm in the flow of this, and I can again find ground in the Eightfold Path. I can rest in the Eightfold Path, and I can find a stillness in the movement of moving through the path. And you know, and as Eliot says, you know, we don't cease our journey till we arrive where we first began and know it for the first time. And there's that aspect to it. So this completes the Four Noble Truths in our time today together, and the presentation is for you to take your practice seriously, as though you're worthy of the practice, and that so you're taking the practice seriously. Because I don't think you doubt the practice or you would give your whole weekend up to do that. But that you are worthy of the practice is not so clear that you really believe that. It's not so clear. This is what I was talking about when I was talking about the choices. Why don't we make these? Why are these gaps? Because in part, we don't really believe we're worthy. We don't really believe we're capable, or if we're capable, we're not worthy, or even if we were capable, we're going to screw it up some other way. We have such doubt about ourselves. And of the five hindrances, I refer to doubt as the mother of all hindrances. Because the others, you're at least in it, and then you're working within it. But doubt stops you before you enter the gates. And that's, man, like, how do you overcome that, you know? Because you don't get any experience to relieve the doubt. And so the antidote to that, by the way, they talk about is inspired faith, where you hear the Dhamma being taught, or you're inspired by hearing or reading or something like that, or witnessing. You witness someone mindfully pick up a glass, and you go, I want to be able to pick up a glass like that, you know? And you know, something like that, that gets you forward. But this, the mother of all hindrances is this doubt. And the biggest doubt is not about the teachings. In my experience with myself, and pretty much, I'd have to say everybody, that not everybody, but the great majority of us, it's certainly not everybody. Anali is a great person where it's not everybody. Joseph Goldstein's another example of not having doubt. it's doubt in ourselves. It's doubt in ourselves. Our both our worthiness and our capability. And if we really believe we're worthy, it may be that then we don't have to consider our capability. Because if we're worthy, why would we not be in the Dhamma? Since the Dhamma is good in the beginning, in the middle, and the end, what is it that stops us? And stops us, like all of these moments of the day when we don't show up from a Dhamma perspective. We don't recognize the suffering. We don't see that we have choice. We don't make the choice. That we do this repeatedly. Get interested in that. Get interested in that and see for yourself and see what happens if you're interested. And again, you're not fixing yourself. You're understanding, you're attending, you're bringing the mindful compassion, or intentional mindful compassion, or compassionate intentional mindfulness, however you want to put those three together. But you have to have mindfulness and intention. But in my experience, you also have to have the compassion, because you know, we screw up so much. You know, we get lost in our demands for perfection, or all of this thing about we're afraid of our capability. So with that, we're going to do our final walking period of the day, and then we'll come back and have a closing. We're going to close promptly at 4:30. I knew today was 4:30, and it turned out in my very package that was given to me coming up here was this schedule saying 4:30 for yesterday. And I had not looked at the package, because on something else it said 5 o'clock, and I was being sloppy, you know, and didn't really look. So in this walking period, I would switch it a little bit to each step you're just being. You're not doing anything. You're not even, you're not doing regular walking practice of staying. You use staying in the body as much as you need to keep yourself in the moment. But just be, Suze. Just be. Can you make it your 20 steps? Big motivation to make it 10 steps. Can you just be for 20 steps? Where you're leaving everything alone. You're letting go of everything. You're just being. You're just being what? Being present. Now, you'll feel body. You may feel emotion. You may have thoughts come and go, but you don't pick up those thoughts. You just let them come and go. You don't give them anything. You just be. So we're going to do it here just for a minute so that you know what it feels like. So you don't have to sit up straight, but you can if you want to, but you just, so it's this stopping, releasing, just be. That's it. Just be. In some ways, it's easier to do sitting, but in other ways, it's harder to do sitting because we've programmed so many things in around sitting. So you're stopping the mind. You're not pulling the emergency brake. It's not that. It's just like not now. Not now. Just being. Just being. Now you'll feel the breath, or you'll feel vulnerability, or you'll feel like, am I doing this or not doing it? You drop all of that. But the breath is going to stay. You're going to have, the mind's not going to be empty because you're walking, so it can't be as, like in a sitting when you can be safely, totally empty, where everything of this realm is closed out. But you're just going to just be. And your aspiration, your goal, is to just make it down your path once. And so you start all over again when you get to the end of the path. It doesn't matter what happened before. When you're turning around, you're turning into a new you. The you that walked down that path is gone. She's gone now. She's not here anymore. They're gone. So now there's a new you and a new moment, and this moment's like this. Just be. There's a degree of will in this, but it's not like this will, but there is a degree of will. This chanda, so there is will, but it's not heavy. And the last group, which is anybody that has not been in the group, come on into the group. Or if somehow I've not recognized you in this room and you're dying to ask something, you can come in that way too. But you can't come in because you want to avoid this the walk. Because this is a time of you having faith in the experience, not the outcome. Oh, we come back at... the bell rings at 4:00, and we're back at 4:05.